Chapter 27. The End of Apartment Number 50. When Margarita reached the final words of the chapter, thus the dawn of the 15th day of Nisan found the 5th procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate. It was already morning. She could hear the sparrows starting their cheerful, excited morning chatter in the branches of the willows and lindens in the courtyard. Margarita rose from the chair, stretched, and only now felt just how broken her body was and how much she wanted to sleep. Interestingly enough, Margarita's mind and soul felt perfectly fine. Her thoughts were not jumbled, and she was completely undisturbed by the fact that she had spent the night in such a supernatural fashion. It did not bother her that she had been at Satan's ball, that by some miracle the master had been returned to her, that the novel had risen from the ashes, and that everything was back in place in the basement apartment now that the sneak Aloysius Mogaric had been banished. In other words, her encounter with Volant caused her absolutely no mental harm. Everything was as it should have been. She went into the adjacent room and made sure that the master was sleeping peacefully and soundly, extinguished the unnecessary table lamp, and stretched out by the opposite wall on a couch draped with an old torn sheet. A minute later, she was asleep and saw no dreams that morning. Silent were the basement rooms. Silent was the whole tiny house. Silent was the secluded alley outside. But at the same time, or at dawn on Saturday, an entire floor was up and busy in a certain Moscow institution. Looking out on a large asphalted square, where humming machines were driving around slowly and cleaning the road with brushes, its fully lit windows cut through the glow of the rising sun. The entire floor was occupied with the investigation of the Volant case. All through the night, lights burned in 10 of its offices. In actual fact, everything had been quite clear since the previous day, Friday, when the Variety had to be closed following the disappearance of its administrators and the various scandals that had taken place earlier during the infamous séance of black magic. The problem was that new information kept arriving constantly on the sleepless floor. The investigators of this strange case, which smacked of outright devilry mixed in with hypnotic tricks and rampant criminal acts, now needed to combine the complex and confusing events that had taken place in various parts of Moscow into a single whole. The first person forced to visit the sleepless, electrically lit floor was Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov, chairman of the Acoustics Commission. On Friday after dinner, a phone rang in his apartment, located in a house by Kameny Bridge, and a male voice asked for Arkady Apollonovich. Arkady Apollonovich's wife answered the phone and grimly stated that Arkady Apollonovich was indisposed and resting, and therefore could not come to the phone. However, Arkady Apollonovich ended up having to do it anyway. When asked who was calling, the voice on the other end very briefly told her.
One minute.
The chairman's usually very condescending wife babbled and flew like an arrow into the bedroom to rouse Arkady Apollonovich from his bed, where he lay suffering hellish torments from the memories of yesterday's séance and the subsequent nighttime scandal that accompanied the expulsion of his Saratov niece from the apartment. It took more than a second, but far less than a minute, and a quarter of a minute later, Arkady Apollonovich was babbling into the phone, wearing only his underwear and left slipper.
"Yes, it's me. I'm listening.
Forgetting all about the despicable crimes of infidelity that the unfortunate Arkady Apollonovich had been found guilty of, his wife peeped out fearfully from the hallway door, thrusting his other slipper in the air and whispering,
"The slipper! Put on the slipper! You'll catch cold!"
Arkady Apollonovich waved away his wife with his bare foot and glared at her savagely as he muttered into the phone.
Yes, of course, I understand. I'm leaving immediately.
Arkady Apollonovich spent the entire evening on the floor where the investigation was headquartered. The conversation was uncomfortable and most unpleasant, for not only did he have to relate with utmost candour the story of the foul séance and the fight that took place in the box seats, but concurrently he also had to provide the very necessary details about Militsa Andreevna Pokobatko from Yelachovskaya Street, about his niece from Saratov, and about many other things that caused Arkady Apollonovich unspeakable pain. It goes without saying that Arkady Apollonovich was an intelligent, sophisticated man who proved to be a sensible and competent witness to the outrageous séance, providing an excellent description of the mysterious masked magician and his two dastardly assistants. He also remembered perfectly well that the magician's name was precisely Volant, and his testimony advanced the investigation considerably. Arkady Apollonovich's statement was juxtaposed with the testimony of others, including that of several ladies who had suffered as a result of the séance, the one in the violet underwear who shocked Rimsky, and, alas, many others, and Karpov, the messenger sent to apartment number 50 on Sadovaya Street. As a result, it was quickly established where the culprit in all these events could be found. They visited apartment number 50, and more than once. Not only did they carefully examine every inch of it, but they also tapped on every wall and examined the chimneys in search of hidden compartments. None of this produced any results, however, and no one was to be found in the apartment during any of the visits. And yet, there was clear evidence of someone being there, despite the fact that every Moscow official who had anything to do with visiting foreign performers insisted firmly and categorically that there were not, that there could not be any black magicians named Volant in the city. He failed to register anywhere upon arriving, and no one had seen his passport or any other documents, contracts or agreements. No one had heard anything of him. Kitaitsev, head of the programming department of the Entertainment Commission, swore that the missing Stiopa Likhodayev had not sent him any programs of any of Volant's shows for approval or told him about Volant's arrival on the telephone. Therefore he, Kitaitsev, had not the slightest idea how Stiopa could have permitted such a séance in the Variety. When they told him that Arkady Apollonovich had personally seen the magician of the séance, Kitaitsev could only spread his hands and raise his eyes to the heavens. And they could tell confidently from those eyes that he was innocent and pure as crystal. As for Prokhor Petrovich, chairman of the main office of the Entertainment Commission, incidentally, he returned to his empty suit immediately after the police appeared in his office, to the ecstatic joy of Anna Richardovna, and to the great confusion of the unnecessarily disturbed police officers. Also, upon returning to his place inside the grey, striped suit, Prokhor Petrovich emphatically approved all the resolutions his suit had drafted during his brief absence. Anyhow, Prokhor Petrovich knew absolutely nothing about anyone named Volant. The picture that emerged was one of utter nonsense. Thousands of spectators, in addition to the entire staff of the Variety, plus a man as highly educated as Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov, had all seen the magician and his thrice-accursed assistants, and yet there was absolutely no way to find him. Did he fall through the earth right after his repugnant séance, I ask you? Or was he never in Moscow in the first place, as some insist? But if one assumed the former, then he had clearly managed to somehow take the entire administration of the Variety with him. Or, in the latter case, one had to conclude that it was the administration itself that had pulled a few dirty tricks. Recall the broken window in the office and the strange behaviour of Ace of Diamonds, and then vanished from the city without a trace. Proper credit is due to the man heading the investigation. The missing Rimsky was located with astounding speed. It was only necessary to place Ace of Diamonds' actions at the cinema taxi stand in the context of certain relevant times of day, such as when the séance ended and the period when Rimsky could have disappeared. Soon, a telegram was dispatched to Leningrad. An hour later, towards Friday evening, a response came, informing them that Rimsky had been found in room 412 of the Hotel Astoria. He was on the fourth floor, next to the room belonging to a repertory manager from one of Moscow's stage groups on tour in Leningrad, in the famous suite with the gilded blue-grey furniture and a luxurious bathroom. Found hiding in the closet of room 412 in the Astoria, Rimsky was immediately arrested and interrogated in Leningrad. A telegram was then sent to Moscow stating that the Variety's finance director was unresponsive, either unable or unwilling to provide straightforward answers to questions, and kept asking only that he be placed in a bulletproof holding cell protected by an armed guard. A telegram from Moscow ordered Rimsky delivered there under guard, and as a result, Rimsky boarded the Friday night train, accompanied by said guard. On the same evening, they also managed to pick up Likhodiev's trail. Telegrams inquiring of his whereabouts were dispatched to every city, and a response from Yalta stated that he had been found there and had already left for Moscow by air. The only trail they failed to pick up was Varionika's. The theatre manager, known to positively all of Moscow, had apparently vanished into thin air. In the meantime, they also had to waste time on things that took place elsewhere in Moscow other than in the Variety Theatre. For one, they had to sort out the incredible case of the staff who were unable to stop singing Grand Old Seascape. Incidentally, Professor Stravinsky managed to straighten them out over the course of 2 hours by means of subcutaneous injections. There were numerous people who presented hell knows what rubbish in the guise of money to other people or institutions, as well as numerous persons who had suffered from such forgeries. Obviously, by far the most unpleasant, scandalous, and inexplicable occurrence was the theft of the deceased Berlioz's head right out of his coffin in the Griboyedov Hall, which took place in broad daylight. 12 men conducted the investigation, gathering, as if on a crochet hook, all the accursed threads of the complex case, scattered all over Moscow. One of the detectives arrived at Professor Stravinsky's clinic and immediately asked to see a list of persons who had been checked into the clinic over the last 3 days. Through this, he was able to locate Nikanor Ivanovich Bosoy and the poor master of ceremonies, whose head had been ripped off. The detective paid little attention to those two, however. It was easy to establish that they had fallen prey to the same criminal gang headed by the mysterious magician. But it was Ivan Nikolaevich Homeless who interested the detective immensely. On Friday night, the door of Ivan's room, number 117, opened, and a young, calm, soft-spoken, round-faced young man stepped inside. He did not look like a detective in the least, yet he was one of Moscow's best. He saw a pale, haggard young man lying on the bed. The young man's eyes displayed a complete lack of interest towards what went on around him. They would either gaze far off into the distance, beyond their surroundings, or else deep within the young man himself. The investigator introduced himself affectionately and said that he was visiting Ivan Nikolaevich to discuss the events that took place at Patriarch's Ponds the day before yesterday. Oh, great would have been Ivan's triumph had the detective come to him earlier, say on Thursday night at least, when Ivan was demanding passionately and violently that his story be heard. Now his wish to assist in the capture of the consultant had come true. He did not need to chase anyone. It was they who came to him with the express purpose of hearing his version of the events that had occurred on Wednesday night. But alas, Ivan had undergone a drastic transformation since the time of Berlioz's death. He answered all of the detective's questions willingly and politely, but the indifference was clear in both his eyes and his tone. Berlioz's fate no longer concerned the poet. Shortly before the detective's arrival, Ivan lay dozing, and various visions appeared before him. He saw a strange, incomprehensible, unreal city, filled with marble hulks and eroded colonnades. He saw roofs glinting in the sunlight. He saw the dark, gloomy, merciless Antonia Tower. He saw a palace on the West Hill, sunk to its very rooftops into a tropical green garden. He saw bronze statues burning in the sunset amid the greenery. He He saw armor-clad Roman sentries pass under the walls of the ancient city. In Ivan's dream, a clean-shaven man with a harried yellow face sat motionless in his chair. A man in a white mantle with red lining, who was gazing hatefully into the lush alien garden. Ivan also saw a treeless yellow hill with empty cross-barred posts. But that which occurred at Patriarch's Ponds no longer interested the poet, Ivan Homeless.
Tell me, Ivan Nikolaevich, how far were you from the turnstile when Bourlioz fell under the tram?
An indifferent, barely noticeable smile appeared on Ivan's face for some reason, and he replied,
I was far away. And the checkered man was near the turnstile? No, he was sitting on a bench nearby.
Can you distinctly recall that he did not approach the turnstile shortly before Berlioz fell?
I can. He didn't. He was sprawled out on the bench.
Those were the detective's last questions. After this, he got up, extended his hand to Ivan, wished him a speedy recovery, and expressed the hope that his poetry would soon reappear in print.
No, Ivan said quietly. I won't write any more poetry.
The detective smiled politely and allowed himself to express his confidence that the poet was suffering from a depression of sorts, but that it would soon pass.
No,
Ivan replied, looking at the distant, fading sky rather than at the detective.
It will never pass. What I wrote was bad poetry. I understand that now.
The detective left Ivan's room with a most important piece of information. Traversing the chain of events from finish to start, he had finally managed to find the source of everything. The detective had no doubt that it all began with the murder on the Patriarchs. Clearly, neither Ivan nor the checkered character had pushed the unfortunate chairman of Massolet under the tram. That is, no one assisted the fall physically, as it were. But the detective was sure that Berlioz had jumped, or fallen, under the tram while in a state of hypnosis. The investigation now had lots of material to work with, and everyone knew who they needed to catch and where. The problem was that they just couldn't seem to be able to do it. It bears repeating that the thrice-accursed apartment, number 50, was undoubtedly inhabited. A rattling or a nasal voice would occasionally answer the telephone, and sometimes the windows would open. Moreover, the sounds of a gramophone would emanate from the apartment. Nonetheless, it was decidedly empty every time they headed over. They had been there more than once already, at different times of day. At one point, they even went over the place with a net, checking all the corners. The apartment had long been under suspicion. Both the courtyard entrance and the fire escape were being watched. Guards were also situated on the roof near the chimney stacks. Yes, something funny was going on in apartment number 50, and yet there was nothing they could do. The stalemate went on until midnight on Friday, when Baron Maigl, dressed in evening attire and patent leather shoes, headed ceremoniously to apartment number 50 as a guest. They heard the Baron being let inside. Exactly 10 minutes later, they entered the apartment without ringing, but did not find any trace of the hosts or, most unusually, any trace of Baron Maigl himself. And so, once again, things dragged on in this fashion until dawn on Saturday, when new and highly interesting information became available. A 6-person passenger plane from the Crimea landed at Moscow's airport, delivering, among others, a very strange passenger. This young gentleman had heavy stubble on his face and had not bathed for 3 days. He had frightened, swollen eyes, lacked luggage, and was somewhat esoterically dressed. The gentleman was wearing a sheepskin hat and a Georgian felt cloak directly over his nightshirt, as well as brand new leather slippers. He had barely time to step off the aircraft ladder when he was intercepted. They had been waiting for him, and soon the Variety's unforgettable director, Stefan Bogdanovich Likhodayev, faced the investigation. He added new information. It became clear that Volant had infiltrated the Variety in the guise of a performer by hypnotizing Stiopa Likhodayev, and then somehow managing to toss him God knows how far out of Moscow. As a result, there was more data to work with, but the work did not get any easier. On the contrary, it was dawning on the investigators that it would not be easy to get their hands on a person able to pull stunts like the one with Stefan Bogdanovich. Notably, Likhodayev was interred in a bulletproof cell by his own request. Meanwhile, Varionika appeared before the investigation, having just been arrested in his apartment, where he had returned after almost 2 days of unexplained absence. Despite promising Azazello to stop lying, the manager began by doing just that. Let us not judge him too harshly, however. After all, Azazello had forbidden him to lie and be rude on the telephone, while in this particular situation the manager was not making use of that device. His eyes wandering, Ivan Savelyevich announced that on Thursday afternoon he had drunk himself into oblivion alone in his office. He could not recall where he went afterwards, only that he had been drinking more, but could not recall where, and that he finally found himself in a ditch, but again he could not recall where. When the manager was told that he would answer for impeding an important investigation with his silly and rash behaviour, Varionika burst into tears and whispered in a trembling voice that he was lying solely because he feared revenge from the Volant gang, who had already got their hands on him once, and that he asks, begs, yearns to be locked up in a bulletproof cell. "What the hell is it with them and that bulletproof cell?" grumbled one of the investigators. "Those bastards really frightened them," said the detective who had visited Ivan. They calmed Varionika as best they could and said they would protect him without the need to resort to a bulletproof cell. Immediately, it was discovered that he had not been drinking in any ditches, but had actually been beaten up by a red-haired man with a fang and another fat one. "Ah, yes, one that looked like a cat."
"Yes, yes, yes," whispered the manager, paralysed with fear and glancing over his shoulder every other second.
He then laid out further details regarding his 2-day stint as a spotter vampire in apartment number 50, as well as how he nearly brought about the doom of finance director Rimsky. Just then, Rimsky was brought in after arriving on the train from Leningrad. Scarcely recognizable as the former finance director, this panic-stricken, psychologically disturbed, grey-haired old man was very stubborn in his refusal to tell the truth. Rimsky insisted that he had seen neither Varionika nor Hella in his office that night, and that he'd simply felt unwell and had left for Leningrad in a moment of confusion. Needless to say, the ill finance director concluded his testimony with a request to inter him in a bulletproof cell. Arnushka was arrested while attempting to give a $10 bill to a cashier in a department store on the Arbat. They listened carefully to her story about the people who had flown out of the window on Sadovaya, as well as the horseshoe that she had allegedly picked up to take to the police. "Did it have real gold and diamonds?" they asked. "As if I don't know my diamonds," Anushka replied. "But you say he gave you 10-ruble bills." "As if I don't know my 10-ruble bills," Anushka replied. "But when did they turn into dollars?"
"I don't know anything about any dollars. I haven't seen any dollars," Anushka squealed. "I was within my rights. I was given a reward and was buying chintz with it."
Here she began rambling some nonsense about not being responsible for the management, which had allowed evil spirits to take residence on the fifth floor, thereby making life unbearable. The detective waved his pen at Anushka, who had been getting on everyone's nerves, and wrote her a pass on a green slip of paper, allowing her to get out. To general satisfaction, Anushka then vanished from the building. After her came a string of various individuals, Nikolai Ivanovich among them. He had just been arrested due to the folly of his jealous wife, who had filed a report with the police that morning that her husband had gone missing. Nikolai Ivanovich failed to surprise the investigators when he produced the laughable document stating that he had spent the night at Satan's ball. Nikolai Ivanovich altered the truth slightly when he told them about flying Margarita Nikolaevna's naked housekeeper to bathe hell knows where on some river, as well as the preceding appearance of a nude Margarita Nikolaevna in the upstairs window. Thus, for instance, he did not deem it necessary to mention that he had gone up to the bedroom carrying the discarded shirt in his hands, or that he had called Natasha Venus. According to him, Natasha flew out of the window, mounted him, and rode him out of Moscow. "I was forced to submit under duress," said Nikolai Ivanovich, concluding his tales with a request not to tell his wife anything. This was promised to him. Nikolai Ivanovich's testimony made it possible to ascertain that both Margarita Nikolaevna and her housekeeper Natasha had vanished without a trace. Measures were taken to find them. Thus, the unceasing investigation went on into Saturday morning. Meanwhile, completely implausible rumours began to emerge and spread through the city, where each infinitesimal grain of truth was embellished with elaborate lies. People were saying that all 2,000 spectators had walked out of a séance at the Variety wearing their birthday suits, that a print shop producing magical counterfeit money had been raided on Sadovaya, that a criminal gang had kidnapped 5 administrators from the entertainment district and was promptly caught, and many other things it is not worthwhile to repeat here. Close to dinner time, the phone rang at the investigation headquarters. Men on Sadovaya were reporting that the damned apartment was again exhibiting signs of life. The windows were opening from the inside, piano music and singing could be heard from within, and a black cat was spotted sunbathing on the windowsill. At around 4 o'clock on the hot afternoon, a large group of plainclothes men emerged from 3 cars that stopped a short distance away from building number 302B on Sadovaya Street. Here, the large group split up into 2 smaller groups, one passing through the gate and across the courtyard towards the 6th entrance, and the other unsealing a small, normally boarded-up door leading to the fire escape. Both began to ascend their respective stairs towards apartment number 50. At this time, Kuravyov and Azazello, the former having traded his festive formal attire for his usual garb, were sitting in the dining room of the apartment and finishing their breakfast. Volant was in the bedroom, as usual, and the whereabouts of the cat were unknown. However, judging by the clattering of pots and pans in the kitchen, Behemoth was presumably there, fooling around, as was his custom.
"Say, what are those steps coming from the staircase?"
Kuravyov asked, twirling his spoon in a cup of black coffee.
"Oh, that's them coming to arrest us,"
Azazello replied, and downed a shot of cognac.
"Well, well,"
Kuravyov said in response. The men on the main staircase were already on the 3rd floor, where 2 plumbers were messing around with a steam heater. The men exchanged meaningful glances with the plumbers.
"Everyone's home," whispered one of the plumbers, tapping his hammer on a pipe.
The leader of the group then openly drew a black Mauser pistol from under his coat, while the man next to him took out a set of master keys. The men heading into apartment number 50 were generally very well equipped. 2 of them were carrying light, easily unfolding silk nets in their pockets. Another had a lasso, still another had gauze masks and bottles of chloroform. In a second, the front door of apartment number 50 was opened, and all the men appeared in the hall. A door slammed in the kitchen, indicating the timely arrival of the 2nd group from the fire escape. This time, the effort was met with at least partial, if not complete, success. The men scattered throughout the rooms and found nothing except for the remnants of an apparently just abandoned breakfast in the dining room and, on the living room mantelpiece, next to a crystal pitcher, an enormous black cat. In his paws was a primus stove. The visitors eyed the cat in complete silence for a considerable length of time.
That's quite something," one of them whispered.
"Not fooling around, not bothering nobody, just sitting here mending the primus,"
said the cat with a hostile frown.
And moreover, I consider it my duty to warn you that the cat is an ancient, inviolable animal.
Exceptionally clean work, whispered another visitor, while a third said loudly and distinctly, All right, come along, you inviolable ventriloquist kitty. A silk net unfurled and flew through the air, but to everyone's surprise, the man throwing the net missed and caught only the jug, which promptly smashed to pieces with a ringing noise.
Forfeit! Bellowed the cat. Hurrah!
And putting aside the Primus, he whipped a Browning automatic from behind his back. He instantly aimed at the man closest to him, but before the cat could fire, something flashed in the target's hand. To the sound of a Mauser shot, the cat flopped head first from the mantelpiece to the floor, dropping the Browning and releasing the Primus.
It's all over,
the cat said in a weak voice, sprawling languidly in a pool of blood.
Leave me alone a moment, and let me say goodbye to the earth. Oh, Azazello, my friend,
the cat moaned, bleeding copiously.
Where are you?
The cat rolled his fading eyes towards the dining room door.
You did not come to my aid in this unequal fight. You abandoned poor Behemoth, trading him for a drink, though a very good one, of cognac. Well then, my death be on your conscience, and I bequeath you my Browning.
The net, the net, the net, the men whispered anxiously around the cat. But hell knows why, the net got stuck in someone's pocket and would not come out.
The only thing that can save a mortally wounded cat, said the cat, is a drink of petrol.
And taking advantage of the confusion, he put his mouth to the round fueling port of the Primus and helped himself to a good drink of petrol. Immediately, the blood stopped streaming from under his front left paw. The cat jumped up, alive and well, tucked the Primus under his arm and leaped back on the mantelpiece. From there, tearing the wallpaper, he scaled the wall and situated himself on a metal curtain rod far above the men. Several hands instantly grabbed the curtain and tore it down together with the rod, causing sunlight to flood the shaded room. But neither the fraudulently healed cat nor the Primus fell to the floor. Without parting with his Primus, the cat soared through the air and landed on the chandelier hanging in the centre of the room.
Get a stepladder,
shouted the men below.
I challenge you to a duel,
bellowed the cat, sailing above their heads on the swaying chandelier. He set the Primus between the branches of the chandelier, and the Browning reappeared in his paws. Swinging like a pendulum above the visitors, the cat took aim and opened fire. Gunshots shook the apartment. Shards of crystal poured down from the chandelier. Star-shaped cracks appeared on the mirror above the mantelpiece. Plaster dust flew everywhere, used casings went bouncing on the floor, window panes shattered, and petrol began to spurt from the bullet-ridden Primus. Taking the cat alive was now out of the question, and the visitors fired their Mausers fiercely and accurately at his head, stomach, chest, and back. The gunfire raised a panic in the courtyard outside. It did not last very long, however, and quickly died down of its own accord. The problem was that neither the cat nor the visitors sustained any damage. Not only was no one killed, but no one was even wounded. Everyone, including the cat, remained completely unharmed. To verify this, one of the visitors pumped at least 5 shots into the head of the accursed animal, and the cat responded briskly with an entire clip. The result was as before. The shooting did not affect anyone. The cat swayed back and forth on the chandelier in progressively smaller arcs, blowing into the muzzle of the Browning for some reason and spitting on his paw. An expression of utter bewilderment appeared on the faces of the men standing below. This was the only time, or at least one of the only times, when shooting proved to be useless. One could assume, of course, that the cat's Browning was a toy, but this certainly could not be said for the visitors' Mausers. As for the cat's first wound, it had undoubtedly been none other than a ruse and a dirty scam, along with the drinking of the petrol. The men made one more attempt to get at the cat. The lasso was thrown and hooked onto one of the chandelier's branches, bringing the whole thing down. The impact seemed to shake the building to its very foundation. But nothing came of it. Shards rained on the visitors as the cat sailed through the air and landed far above the floor on the golden frame of the mantelpiece mirror. He had no intention of running away. On the contrary, now that he was sitting in relative safety, the cat commenced yet another speech.
"I fail to understand," he spoke from above, "the reasons for such harsh treatment of my person."
And then his speech was interrupted by a low, heavy voice coming out of nowhere.
"What's going on in the apartment? You are interrupting my work."
An unpleasant nasal voice replied,
"It's Behemoth, of course, damn him to hell."
A third rattling voice said,
"Messiah, it's Saturday. The sun is setting. Time to go." "Forgive me, but I cannot stay and chat,"
the cat said from the mirror.
"Time to go."
He hurled his Browning and knocked out both window panes. Then he poured petrol on the floor and it ignited spontaneously, raising a wall of fire all the way to the ceiling. The unusual fire burned faster and stronger than regular petrol. The wallpaper instantly began to smoke, the torn curtains ignited on the floor, and the window frames began to smoulder. With a meow, the cat coiled up, jumped from the mirror onto the windowsill, and disappeared together with his primus. Shots came from outside. The man sitting on the iron fire escape ladder on level with the apartment's windows fired at the cat as the latter soared from windowsill to windowsill, heading towards the corner drainpipe of the U-shaped building. The cat climbed up the pipe to the roof. There, he came under equally ineffective fire from the men guarding the chimney stacks and made off into the sunset flooding the city. Meanwhile, in the apartment, the parquet floor burst into flames under the visitor's feet. In the spot where the cat had been lying with his fake wound, the corpse of the former Baron Maigel congealed from the air, glassy-eyed, with its chin thrust high up. There was no way to get it out. Hopping on the burning parquet tiles and beating out their smouldering chests and shoulders, the men in the living room retreated to the study and the hall. Those who had been in the dining room and bedroom ran out through the corridor. Finally, the men from the kitchen also came running to the front door. The living room was already full of fire and smoke. Someone managed to dial the fire department on his way out and shouted curtly into the phone, "Sadovaya, 302B! They could not stay any longer. The fire spread into the hall. It became difficult to breathe. As soon as the first wisps of smoke appeared from the broken windows of the haunted apartment, frantic voices came from the courtyard below. "Fire! Fire! We're on fire!" In various apartments, people began to scream into their telephones, "Sadovaya! Sadovaya! 302B! And just as they heard the heart-stopping sound of bells on the long red trucks speeding towards Sadovaya from all over the city, the people running around the courtyard saw three dark, seemingly male silhouettes fly out of the fifth-floor window amid the smoke, as well as one silhouette of a nude woman.